Welcome to Akatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI.
Welcome back, everyone. Today, we're really going to take the plunge into, well, just an essential piece of modern American writing, Colson Whitehead's The Underground Railroad. It's a novel that really resonates.
Oh, absolutely. It's an astounding book. And yeah. Whitehead, I mean, he's operating on such a high level, isn't he? A two-time Pulitzer winner. He blends genres so masterfully.
He does. And his signature move, it seems, is this kind of brilliant intellectual sleight of hand. He takes these core American myths, things we think we know, like the Underground Railroad.
And he makes them literal.
Yeah.
Startlingly literal.
Exactly. So let's unpack that, because the premise is, well, it's everything here. You've got this historical network, right? Secret routes, safe houses.
Right.
We all know the idea.
But in Whitehead's hands, it becomes an actual physical industrial thing, a real subterranean railway. Tracks, engines, conductors, stations, mm-hmm. all running deep into the slave South.
And that literal train, that's the engine of the whole story, isn't it? Both literally and, you know, figuratively, it shifts the whole thing.
It really does. It takes it from maybe standard historical fiction into something else.
Mm-hmm.
Magical realism, maybe.
Yeah.
A kind of searing allegory. It makes the journey dynamic geographically and, well, philosophically too.
And that's really our mission for you today, to explore how Whitehead uses this literal railroad, this structure, to create a kind of episodic map, a map showing, as our sources put it, the manifold forms of American racism as it changes or maybe just adapts from state to state.
Yeah, and we follow our protagonist, Cora, on this absolutely harrowing quest, a quest for, well, what is true freedom. Self-possession, maybe?
Let's start at the beginning, then. Georgia, the Randall Plantation. Set the scene for us.
Okay, Georgia, it's just unrelenting brutality. It's the nightmare you imagine. Systematic dehumanization on a cotton plantation. And Cora, our protagonist, she starts from this place of deep isolation.
Yeah, she's guarded, isn't she? Living under the shadow of her mother, Mabel, who escaped years before, which is its own trauma for Cora.
A huge trauma. She sees it as abandonment. And the only thing she really holds on to, this tiny bit of selfhood, is this small garden plot her grandmother left her.
Mm-hmm.
It's symbolic, right? The only thing that's truly hers.
Mm-hmm. Until Caesar arrives, he's the spark, the catalyst.
He is. Caesar's another enslaved man, intelligent, and he convinces her finally to run. But, oh, the stakes just shoot through the roof almost immediately.
How so?
Well, during the escape, it's desperate, chaotic, and Cora ends up killing a young white boy who tries to stop them, a kid.
Oh, wow. So that act, it just transforms everything for her.
Instantly. She's not just a runaway anymore in the eyes of the law or, you know, the slave catchers. She's a murderer.
Yeah.
So the pursuit becomes incredibly intense across state lines, life and death.
And that pursuit has a face, doesn't it? Arnold Ridgway. He's the shadow hanging over her entire journey.
He is. The primary antagonist. A legendary slave catcher, known for being relentless. But what's fascinating and terrifying is that he's not just some brute. He's ideological.
Right. He has this whole philosophy, this twisted view of America.
Exactly. He calls it the great American spirit. It's this belief system, basically, that the strong, meaning white men have this inherent right to dominate, to control. He sees himself as enforcing the natural, fundamental order of things.
And he has that assistant, Homer. That detail is so chilling.
Oh, Homer, yes. A free black boy, wearing livery, meticulously noting down Ridgway's transactions in a ledger. He's like the embodiment of how white supremacy can co-opt and corrupt everyone, even those it doesn't technically enslave. It's deeply unsettling.
And for Ridgway, catching Cora isn't just a job, is it? It becomes personal.
Very personal. We learn his one big professional failure, the stain on his record, was failing to recapture Cora's mother, Mabel, all those years ago.
Mm.
So chasing Cora is about his pride, his ideology, his past failures. It's all wrapped up together.
So his obsession becomes this dark mirror to her own desperate fight for freedom. He wants to impose his order. She just wants to exist on her own terms.
Precisely. And that tension, knowing he's always back there, maybe just one step behind,
mm-hmm.
that's what gives the novel so much of its kinetic energy, its urgency. It forces her onto those tracks.
And those tracks, as we said, they aren't just heading north geographically. They lead through this kind of thematic landscape of oppression. That episodic structure is so key.
Yeah, Whitehead uses it brilliantly to show how this mutating virus of racism, as the source material calls it, just puts on a different mask in each state.
Each stop is a new nightmare, essentially.
Pretty much, yeah. The different case study in horror.
So let's talk about the first major stop after Georgia, South Carolina. When I first read this, the contrast was stark. How does Whitehead use South Carolina to explore this idea that progress can be its own kind of trap?
Well, South Carolina presents itself as this. This illusion of progress.
Yeah.
Cora actually finds a bit of fragile normalcy there. She gets a job at a museum. She starts taking classes. There's talk of education, proper medical care. For a moment, she thinks maybe this is it. Maybe she's safe.
There's an intellectual awakening there too, isn't there?
Yes. She starts learning to read. But like you said, it's a facade. It crumbles pretty quickly when she uncovers the truth.
It is.
Which is that this supposed benevolence is cover for a really sinister social engineering project. The state is pushing forced sterilizations on Black women, conducting horrific medical experiments. Basically, eugenics disguises public health and uplift.
So it's racism just wearing a lab coat instead of carrying a whip. Administrative control over bodies, not just physical chains.
Exactly. And that realization that even apparent kindness can be a weapon, a form of control, is devastating. It forces her to flee again, this time alone, into even greater danger.
Which brings her to North Carolina. And if South Carolina was insidious, North Carolina is something else entirely.
Oh, North Carolina is the absolute extreme. It's genocidal racism, plain and simple. The state has systematically wiped out almost its entire Black population. It's founded on this idea of absolute white purity.
And the imagery Whitehead uses here is just unforgettable, visceral, that freedom trail.
Yeah, the main road, lined with the bodies of lynched Black people, runaways, and even white people who tried to help them, just left hanging there as a constant public spectacle of terror.
It's horrific. And Cora's experience there highlights a different kind of imprisonment, doesn't it?
It does, because she ends up hiding for months. Literally months, in this tiny, cramped, dark attic space belonging to a station agent, Martin Wells, who's sympathetic but terrified himself.
So she's physically free from the plantation, but psychologically?
Psychologically, she's utterly trapped, living in constant, agonizing fear of being discovered. It's an incredible depiction of psychological torment.
So if you take these states together, the raw violence of Georgia, the scientific control of South Carolina, the outright extermination in North Carolina, it just hammers home that core idea, doesn't it? Oppression is constant. It just changes its methods.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There's that quote from our sources that captures it so well. Stolen bodies working stolen land. It was an engine that did not stop. Its hungry boiler fed with blood.
Yeah. That engine just keeps running. The violence is foundational. The means just adapt.
Exactly.
Okay, so after that descent into the absolute darkness of North Carolina, you feel like the story almost owes Cora and the reader a moment of light, right?
Yeah.
And we get that briefly in Indiana.
Yes, Indiana. Specifically, the Valentine Farm. This is like a genuine gasp of fresh air in the narrative. It's presented as this thriving, independent Black community, a kind of utopia almost.
What makes it utopian?
Well, it's built on principles of education, cooperative farming, intellectual discussion, self-determination. People are reading, debating, building something together. And importantly for Cora, it's where she finally finds a sense of real belonging, purpose, and even allows herself to experience love with Royal.
Royal, the railroad operator, he's quite a charismatic figure.
He is. Mm. And their relationship allows Cora to open up in ways she never could before. It's really the highest point of hope in the whole novel. She's surrounded by community, intellect, relative safety.
But Whitehead is too smart for easy answers, isn't he? He immediately starts to question how stable this sanctuary can really be. Can this kind of Black utopia survive inside a nation that's fundamentally hostile to its existence?
And the answer the novel gives is, well, it's tragic. It's a resounding no. That external white resentment, the fear of Black success and independence, it's always there, boiling under the surface.
It erupts.
It erupts violently. A mob of white vigilantes attacks the farm. They burn it to the ground, slaughter people. Royal is killed. The whole dream of a safe collective freedom is just violently shattered, annihilated.
Just devastating. And after that loss, Cora finds herself captured, back in Ridgway's clutches. And they travel through Tennessee.
Yeah, briefly recaptured. That journey through Tennessee is another low point. The landscape itself feels wounded, ravaged by fires, disease. It mirrors the destruction of the farm, the violence of westward expansion, maybe, and Cora's own internal state.
It's also where we get deeper into Ridgway's mindset, right?
We do. We learn more about his rejection of his own father's more compassionate blacksmithing life, how he deliberately chose this path, embraced this brutal American imperative as he sees it.
But even in captivity, Cora's own resolve seems to be hardening, doesn't it? Her journey, all these experiences, they're reinforcing that core theme.
Absolutely. That freedom isn't just a place you get to or a piece of paper. It's this constant, ongoing struggle, a struggle for self-possession, for the right to define your own life, your own existence. She has to seize it. It won't be given.
Which she finally does in the climax. It happens back at another Indiana station, doesn't it? Ridgway corners her again.
He does. But this time is different. Cora takes decisive action. Real physical agency. She fights back. She manages to push Ridgway, who's already wounded, down a flight of stairs.
Mortally wounding him.
Mortally wounding him. And then she flees again, escaping onto a handcar, heading west into the unknown. It's a powerful moment of liberation, but one born from violence itself.
A really complex moment, but yeah. The novel isn't quite done with us emotionally. There's still the final revelation about Mabel.
Yeah, Mabel. Yes. This is the final crushing blow. Throughout the book, Cora's life has been shaped by this belief, this wound, that her mother abandoned her.
Ran off and left her behind on the plantation.
Exactly. But right near the end, we learn the devastating truth. Mabel didn't abandon Cora. She escaped, yes, but she tried to return. She turned back for her daughter, and she died in the swamp, bitten by a snake while trying to get back to Cora.
Oh, that just recontextualizes everything, doesn't it?
Completely. What Cora perceived as the ultimate act of abandonment was actually rooted in an attempt at the ultimate maternal sacrifice. Her own desperate flight for freedom suddenly feels like the unconscious fulfillment of her mother's final desperate wish for her child. It's heartbreaking.
So after all that, this incredible journey, this reevaluation of her own past, what's the final feeling the novel leaves you with?
Yeah.
It forces you to look squarely at America's origins, right?
Absolutely. It holds nothing back. It really reinforces that critique voiced within the novel itself, that the whole American project, the ideal, is built on, quote, murder, theft, and cruelty.
The literalized railroad exposes the literal foundations.
Yes. I think the great power of the book is its unslinting clarity. It makes you realize the past isn't really past at all.
Its structures, its ghosts, they're still shaping everything. But alongside that,
there's the human spirit. The capacity to resist, to fight back, to try and reclaim some measure of dignity, that remains. It's an unyielding force, even in the face of overwhelming horror.
It really is a profound, necessary, and ultimately unforgettable epic. Resistance, imagination, survival. It just compels you to see the American story in a new, much harsher, but maybe truer light. This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Acotra Foundation.